Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for traditional exercise like weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447, Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
It's Wednesday, December 4th, 2013, and this is KBIA's Views of the News. Our weekly roundtable on media behaviors comes to you from the Futures Lab studio at the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Amy Simons, and here with me are Missouri School of Journalism colleagues Mike McKean and Jim Flink, who's here with us today for Ernest Perry. On our program this week, the stock market. It's soaring, but the audience for cable networks devoted to covering it, it's changed the channel. Why are CNBC, Fox Business, and Bloomberg TV struggling to keep us tuned in? And an interview aired Monday morning on CNN's New Day is raising some eyebrows. Should anchor Chris Cuomo have done the interview with the New York governor the morning after a deadly train derailment? Reason I ask, the governor is his brother. And more than three dozen news agencies come together to fight for better access to President Obama. But let's start with a story that's generating buzz, quite literally, in both journalism and commerce circles. Sunday night, Amazon CEO Jeff Bezos sat down with 60 Minutes' Charlie Rose for a pre-Cyber Monday feature that pretty much amounted to a 14-minute commercial for the online giant. During their discussion, Bezos talked about the growth of the business, including branching into television production with the new series Alpha House, and his same-day grocery deliveries now available in two West Coast markets. But this is what really created the buzz.
Let me show you something.
Oh, man. Oh, my God.
This is? These are octocopters.
Yeah.
These are effectively drones, but there's no reason that they can't be used as delivery vehicles. Take a look up here so I can show you how it works.
All right. We're talking about delivery here.
We're talking about delivery. So there's an item going into the vehicle. I know this looks like science fiction. It's not.
Maybe not science fiction, but it's not necessarily being taken seriously either. Here's CNN's Jeannie Moose.
No sooner had Charlie Rose expressed his wonder.
Oh, my God.
No sooner had Amazon's delivery drone lifted off in this promotional video when the drone was attacked by mockery.
Navigating through the parts of America with no trees, phone lines, or buildings, then landing on your doorstep while your family cowers inside.
Is it Amazon Prime Air or Hot Air? Will it join the flying taco and the flying cake? Is it a bird? Is it a plane? Is it a publicity stunt?
So that's my question for you.
Was it a publicity stunt? Yeah. Well, on the part of Amazon, it certainly was. I mean, Bezos and Amazon manipulated CBS, willingly or not, masterfully, I thought. I mean, it runs on the Sunday before Cyber Monday. Was that a condition for the story? I don't know that we'll ever know. But if you looked at that story in its entirety, it was nothing but, as you said, basically a 14-minute commercial for Amazon.
Well, and I think there is an audience sort of curiosity about Amazon and about going inside. The fact of the matter is, though, that you can't, after sitting through this 14-minute interview and then the 6 minutes or 4 or 5 minutes that they have on the website, after the show, CBS comes across as a little bit sort of Mayberry-ish in all of this, like, golly, you know, and you have to wonder, seriously, you are a serious news magazine, and yet you do this and you go along with this. Yeah, I mean, it begs questions.
The golly part of it was most, brought home most for me when, I mean, they're fawning over these. Well, they're like little helicopters, and it was like you'd never heard of drones before. And I actually believe, unlike some of the critics of the story, that Amazon can pull this off in the next few years. Drones can be made to do exactly what he's talking about if they clear certain regulatory hurdles. But maybe it's just because the audience for 60 Minutes is, 60 plus or whatever, in line with the people who are delivering those stories, and maybe they don't know what drones are.
So you mentioned that maybe if we surpass regulatory hurdles, this could happen. We've seen the regulatory hurdles with drones and journalism here. Jeff Bezos is the new owner of the Washington Post. Is there potential for crossover there? Does he have the juice to maybe push something through?
Well, maybe. But most people who are looking at this with any sort of jaundiced eye are saying this is 10, 12, 14 years out, not 2 years out, not really. This is more pie in the sky right now than it is anything that's realistically going to happen. And yet, again, CBS seems to just be going for this thing hook, line, and sinker, like this is the coolest thing since sliced bread, when in reality – These aren't just a few hurdles to overcome. I mean, from national security to all sorts of practical sorts of issues, this is not going to happen anytime soon.
You know, I didn't have as much of a problem with the gee whiz factor of it because I really do believe technologically and in terms of regulations, this can happen soon-ish. I don't know if it's 20 years away, maybe more like 5 or 7 years away. What really bothered me about the story was the total lack of balance if you're talking about Amazon, because the drone part was at the very end, right? The rest of the story was a very fawning look at all the technologies and the processes that Amazon uses to reach customers. There's a lot of reporting that has been done out there by other sources about the other side of the coin, some of the labor problems that Amazon has had, what it's like working in one of those fulfillment centers, the way they actually time you to determine whether you perform certain tasks within a specific time on the clock, and then supervisors coming around and telling you, well, you were supposed to have done 116 deliveries and you only got 105. Bad for you. That kind of stuff could have been included, at least at some summary level, in a 16-minute piece on 60 Minutes, but it wasn't.
And in fact, Mike, the thing is, you know, that's the kind of thing you would expect from 60 Minutes. Mm-hmm. But here you've got, you know, a very popular Sunday magazine show coming on after a football show. And I think this becomes the challenge for CBS, for 60 Minutes, and for journalism as a whole. How many people will tune in to an expose about Amazon versus an inside look right before the biggest shopping day of the year? And the fact of the matter is, I think that there are too many people in the audience, you can argue the merits and demerits of it all you want, who want to see the lighter, fluffier inside, how they pack compartments to make maximum use, you know, all that kind of stuff, which is fascinating, but it's really not 60 Minutes is thing,
so,
and it probably shouldn't have been.
So there was one very interesting nugget in that interview that got buried in all of the talk of the drones.
Amazon figured out it could also expand that infrastructure to store data and run websites for hundreds of thousands of companies and government agencies on what is known as the cloud.
How much of the internet do you run?
It's a good question. It's a lot, though.
What's a lot? What's the neighborhood?
I can tell you this. Most internet startups and a lot of big internet companies run on top of AWS. Netflix, very famously, and you could say, oh, that's very odd because Netflix, in a way, is a competitor of Amazon.
Other than Netflix, who else uses AWS?
Oh, big enterprises, big government institutions.
Like the CIA.
The CIA.
Does that present any conflict for you, the fact that you provide the cloud that the CIA uses for its data?
I don't think so. We're building what's called a private cloud for them, Charlie, because they don't want to be on the public cloud.
So, Mike, you talked about a lack of balance, a lack of bringing in checking Bezos and Amazon in any way. Here he's talking about the private cloud, the CIA monitoring and using its software and its programming.
What could be more timely than that? Yeah. And yet there either wasn't a follow-up question or was left on the cutting room floor, one of the two. That's really interesting to me. Now, again, here's your gee whiz factor. The cloud? What's the cloud? But I do think that it puts Amazon, that statement by Bezos, puts Amazon sort of at odds with a lot of the other big tech companies, you know, the Googles and Microsofts, the others who are actually trying to press the government to let them be more transparent about what sort of monitoring is being done through their servers. Here's Amazon building a private cloud for the CIA.
And this is really more troubling. And a couple of weeks ago, we talked about the whole Lara Logan thing. And, you know, this is more troubling about what you're beginning to see more and more out of 60 Minutes, which is this sort of lack of checks and balances going on, apparently, within the organization that says, why aren't we asking the questions we used to ask, and why are we just going along with this line of reasoning or this line of discussion that's very much playing into our sources' hands?
Okay. Well, there was a piece that caught my eye in yesterday's Wall Street Journal. At a time when the U.S. stock market is soaring, investors are coming back in ways we haven't seen in years. But the television networks that cover them are seeing their audiences decline pretty steeply. In the third quarter, CNBC, the dominant business news channel, hit a 20-year low in its 24 to 54-year-old target demo. And Nielsen data shows average daytime viewership is down 50% since 2008. Bloomberg is said to be rethinking its TV business model after failing to turn a profit in more than two decades. And Fox Business Network, which remains on a long-term growth trajectory, is still falling short of media buyers' expectations. Why do you think there's been the drop-off?
I think part of it is people don't understand business. And I think too much of what business channels cover are things like ETFs and, you know, spiders and all these things that people just on a day-to-day basis, they do not understand them. I think the other thing is that the way these programs are often couched, it's inside baseball. And, you know, at least with baseball, I get to see the game. But, you know, in so much of what's going on in business, you know, most Americans have never been to Wall Street. Yes, they might have a 401k, although after 2008, I think that there's this sort of sense of, you know, I don't know what that is or how real that is. So I think there are all sorts of disconnects that go on. And the challenge for business journalism is to take their stories and to make them real for Main Streeters.
I think part of it actually might be the fact that the drop-off may or may not be real or may not be as big as we're talking about, because Nielsen, the company that does the ratings for all of television, including these channels, is notoriously bad in terms of its technology being able to monitor viewing in the office and other places where there might be a lot of business people watching it. And also think that these networks, especially the ones that are winning, like CNBC, are probably thinking, as long as I'm still super serving that very exclusive niche of viewers I'm going after, and the advertisers recognize that and continue to provide the revenue to keep it going, they don't really care. But I think the bigger problem is not the ratings. The bigger problem is that those people in that prime target, these business people who make investment decisions, they have a lot of online sources now to get information that they need to make those decisions. They don't have to go to TV to get it.
So that was going to be another one of my questions, and where I wanted to go with this next is that this Wall Street Journal article was looking at audience drop-off since 2008. That was about the same time that smartphones were really beginning to proliferate the market. And how much of this is the same type of thing you've been seeing from the Weather Channel, where people are going to their phones and the Weather Channel app is incredibly popular, but who sits at home and watches the Weather Channel?
Well, and if you look at Bloomberg's app right now, they live stream shows, they have great video segments, they have a lot of news. So yeah, you know, you get the sense this is a lot of different variables that are coming into play, and it's not just any one thing, because with the emergence of smart technology and these things that you're carrying around now, when they're carrying at least as much information, if not more, in the same kinds of ways, and the analytics might be a little bit harder to get your arms around, yeah, it's definitely having a contribution.
And we're seeing some changes, too, in their primetime programming strategies.
Well, some of them are talking about doing more and CNBC is doing more sort of entertainment-oriented programming in primetime. I don't know if that makes sense or not. And you see different kinds of reactions. Bloomberg, which makes most of its money not off of television programming and advertising, but off these terminals that they sell throughout the world. Maybe if TV's not working for them, it's easy enough to just jettison it.
Okay. Well, Sunday morning, four people died after a commuter train from Poughkeepsie, New York, derailed in the Bronx before reaching its intended destination at New York City's Grand Central Station. The NTSB's initial investigation shows the train tried to maneuver a turn at 80 miles per hour, more than 50 over the posted speed limit. The coverage of the incident wasn't remarkable or different than anything we might have expected until this interview that ran on CNN's New Day on Monday morning. Anchor Chris Cuomo interviews the governor of New York about the investigation, his brother Andrew.
Now, obviously, to those who don't know, we're family, so we've been talking about this a lot. Yesterday, you hurried down to the scene. There was talk immediately, well, maybe it was the curve, maybe it's an unsafe condition. You've taken a little bit of a different line on that. What do you think the questions are to figure out why this happened?
Well, they said there are three options. Number one, there was a problem with the track. Number two, equipment error. There's a rumor that the brakes on the train didn't work. Or number three is just an operator error. This is at the point of it on the track. There's a turn. It's a sharp turn, but it's not just about the turn. The turn has been here for decades. Trains negotiate the turn all day long. So it's not about the turn. Something else had to happen, and we want to find out what it is. There's a lesson to learn from it. We will. That's why the NTSB being here, I think, is very helpful. They're an independent agency. They're all about the facts, and whatever it is, it is.
So let's talk about the ethics here. Chris Cuomo discloses, people know we're related. Should he have been the one to do the interview in the first place?
I didn't have a problem with it. I mean, could they have found somebody else to do the interview? Probably. Did they need to in this particular circumstance? No, because I didn't think there was anything controversial politically going on. Did Chris Cuomo do a good job with his brother? One, he disclosed, but he also asked him some pretty tough questions, I thought. And so I think it's not that big a deal.
You know, I would say on the face of it, in this particular situation, it may not be that big a deal. On the other hand, I do think that at some point there becomes a series of lines that you draw in terms of this is your brother. You may not be the best person. What if an important question isn't asked? What if you don't do what, in fact, he did? So give him credit for doing it. But, I also – someone in a news executive position is making this decision. And I wonder what else is behind that decision. Are we trying to bolster Chris Cuomo's sort of credentials as connected to the governor? And, there are other things. So on the face of it, yeah, nothing went wrong here. There was nothing that seemed unethical about it. On the other hand, if I'm an executive and I have another newscaster that's in the room, I think I'm giving it to the other newscaster, if for no other reason than on the face of it, for appearances' sake. Mm-hmm. It's probably a better decision.
And with that show, there were at least two other people who could have gone ahead and done that interview. It was interesting to me, one of the people who came to Chris Cuomo's defense was Greta Van Susteren from Fox News. Why would she have done that?
I mean, one, she has has a legal background, and I think just one TV personality coming to the defense of another, I don't see anything, sinister or under the table about that. I just think that, in fact, I don't think there were a lot of media people there. I think maybe one person on Salon or something made some sniping comment or whatever, but most media people either stayed out of it or seemed to be on his side.
Now, is a legal conflict of interest different than a media conflict of interest? Is it really fair to hold those in the same vein?
I tell you what, I think what's more interesting to me about this whole thing is sort of how it lays bare once again the incestuousness of the power relationships between politics and media, especially in New York and Washington. I mean, you've got the Cuomo brothers. You've got Chelsea Clinton being on TV, Jenna Bush being on TV. Anderson Cooper comes from a very prominent social family in New York. Diane Sawyer was connected to
Andrea
Richard Nixon.
Mitchell.
On and on and on. And it just suggests to me that how incestuous it is and how difficult it is for other folks to crack that sometimes.
I don't think there's any question about that. And that leads to the next issue, which is this question of impartiality. And we start the show with Charlie Rose, who is venerable and revered, and yet, very guffawish in this interview. And what we see increasingly, especially in television journalism, where I spent two decades, is too many people that are more interested in their image and their ability to rub a shoulder with someone else in a visible position than sometimes doing the journalism that needs to be done. So if there's anything that circles around this, if there's any more critical thought that needs to be lent to it, it's maybe more on the industry-wide that says too many broadcasters, too many newscasters are worried about being in that circle that you mentioned, Mike.
And just one other kind of related thing, if I could, Amy. It reminds me of another story this week talking about unpaid internships at New York publishing houses and media companies and how it basically leads to only well-to-do young people getting these internships. And maybe that's why one figure was one in five of them, those interns are connected to somebody else who's already in the company. So you just have this incestuous circle that's very, very difficult to break through.
Well, our next topic is one that's been bubbling up for the better part of the last month or so, is photographers who cover the White House say the Obama administration is keeping them at arm's length, opting instead to hand out photos taken by official photographer Pete Souza. USA Today was among the first to speak out, refusing to publish White House photos. This video, produced for the USA Today website, compares the quality of images when placed side by side.
In the top picture taken by Mills here, you can barely see the first family. But Souza had access to the president taking a swim with his daughter. Photographers were allowed to take a single shot of the president in Nelson Mandela's jail cell, but were excluded from the cell when Obama was with his family hugging Sasha.
Late last month, the White House Correspondent Association sent a letter to Press Secretary Jay Carney saying that this has been a major break from the way past administrations has worked with the press. Some say Sousa hit below the belt, tweeting this image of photographers in the Oval Office with the president, basically sending the message that the whole thing is much ado about nothing. Is the administration trying to use Pete Sousa as White House photographer to limit access?
By all appearances, it is. But this would not be inconsistent with this administration, which has chosen to sort of circumvent and bypass the way that previous administrations have dealt with the media to take the message to the people themselves. And I would say that we are going to see more of this, not less of this. That is to say, I don't know that I think that this is necessarily unique to the Obama administration. I believe that corporations are going to start doing this. They're going to be taking their own messages, politicians, because there are means to do it. And so what's happening right now, at least one way to look at it, is all of this technology is coming to bear, all of this these abilities to get information through other sources than, you know, the allocated channels on your television set or the newspaper that arrives in your driveway. And this administration is choosing to seize the opportunity.
They're obviously doing it. They're obviously getting away with it. And despite a few attempts to pretend like they're being responsive to it over the past week by letting photographers in, news photographers into a couple of events, they're going to continue to do it. And I think part of the problem here is not just that it's journalistically questionable, but it's getting right at the bottom line of news companies, because basically using social media, the White House photographer is out there competing with these news organizations for eyeballs. And that's not going to stop either.
So is that something we should, as journalists, as professionals, should we be fighting the good fight? Or is this something that we need to concede and know that there are other places to direct those resources and other ways to attempt to cover this president and this administration?
I would say yes and yes. I mean, yes, you should fight the good fight. Yes, you should take it to the administration and say, this is about democratic access. This is about getting, you know, getting in front of the press and being very transparent. On the other hand, media companies also need to understand where they can find their own advantages and seize those.
You know, you had a couple of news organizations. I think USA Today said, we're not going to use any of those White House photos. The New York Times is saying, maybe we'll only use them in an emergency, like maybe if you have the Osama bin Laden, you know, photograph or whatever inside the war room. You can only go so far with a boycott like that, though, because, again, the administration has the audience, sometimes probably larger than the audiences of these traditional news organizations, just by going direct through these social media channels.
Okay, well, many of those photos and video that Pete Sousa has put out on Flickr and Instagram and Twitter himself, they've gone viral, and some have even ended up embedded on sites like Gawker, BuzzFeed, and Upworthy. Well, there are several new viral video aggregators out there as well, building an audience in near record time. Take, for example, Viral Nova. The site launched last May, and according to the web analytics company Alexa, at that time ranked among the 448,000th most popular website on the internet. That's somewhere around 500,000. Well, now it ranks in the top 1,500, passing up NPR and the New York Post, among others. Content is most often reached on Viral Nova and some of these other sites through Facebook shares, and it's designed to create an emotional response among readers. There's been a mix of scorn and fear. Where and how?
You know, to me, they're taking a lot of things that we're teaching people to do to try to engage audiences, right? Using video, using photographs, using these headlines that are basically equipped to get people engaged, and using tags so that we can find these stories. They're doing all those things, but they're just taking them to the nth degree, right? I mean, a couple from Viral Nova. I had never even seen this site before. These headlines: please ban these people from ever posting online again. You have to see this. OMG. Or, I can't decide if this is adorable or very, very wrong, and I'm not talking about the baby's safety. A headline over a kid, a little baby on a motorcycle or whatever. Those things grab your attention. And this is just sort of the ultimate extension of all of those things that we know about how audiences interact with content online.
Scorn and fear, yes and yes. And and here's the thing that journalists and big and small all need to learn from these experiences. These folks are getting audiences, and in this instantaneous age, and as you said, SEO optimization, all these sorts of things. Here's the encouraging thing. Mm-hmm. This gentleman is picking 12 stories a day, and he's got a good sense for what's going to hit and what isn't, and he's outperforming a lot of these computers that are picking headlines. So the good news out of this for journalists is it's a person doing this. The bad news is some of our really big and sort of revered news organizations are having a hard time figuring out how to do this in other ways with really important news, and that's a problem.
So how do we do that? Is there a way for traditional journalism outlets to compete with this?
I mean, when I read the piece that you posted on our blog from the Gawker guy that, mm-hmm. who puts up the 12 stories a day, and he talks about his thought processes and how he's just scanning the environment all the time, and he's just sort of intuitively connecting with the audience and what the audience is interested in, we should all be doing that as journalists. We should all be better at being audience-centric and just having that come up sort of automatically. I mean, I think the other thing that we can probably learn from it is, how do we make a call to action in the content that we put online? I mean, they do a very good job of just saying, look at this, look at this. Here's how it's going to tug at your heartstrings. Can you believe this? Very personally oriented call to action. We should do that.
And I believe it was Upworthy that said they write 12 headlines for every single story, mm-hmm. and attempt to find the one that will draw in the people the best, and to give every story 12 headlines, and to try and figure out
And in the industry, we call that A-B testing, although this is A through J testing. It mm-hmm. sounds like or whatever it might be. So it's important because I think even within the life of a story, a different headline's going to resonate at a different point. And in this day and age, headline writing, first of all, so very important, staying relevant to the discussion that's going on virtually even more important.
I guess the other thing I took from this that I see as a positive, mm-hmm. I mean, there was a time, there still is a time on television news where you have the entertaining stories, the kickers, the human interest stuff that draws you to the newscast so that maybe you'll pay attention to the investigative stuff or the government stuff. In the newspaper world, that's all kind of gotten disaggregated, right? Well, now these folks are coming along and saying, especially if you look at somebody like BuzzFeed, they're saying, we're going to use these strategies to get you in the door to generate the revenue so that maybe we can do other kinds of reporting.
So for a site like Viral Nova, which has built its entire user base through Facebook shares, is that dangerous? Looking maybe at how some of these other companies like Zynga or Slide, we all used to super poke, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. But then kind of it fell out of favor on Facebook. If you're relying your entire business model on sharing through Facebook, is there a potential for a bubble to burst there?
Well, there may be, but I think there are all sorts of bubbles out there. There are all sorts of dangers that we're navigating in this rapidly changing environment. And so, you know, you can look at it as dangerous or exhilarating or however you want to look at it. You just better understand that the lifespan of stories and sometimes what you're doing can be very short, and you better stay relevant.
Does Facebook want to pull the plug on these ventures? Not right now, I don't think, because they've got a nice relationship going there. Could they? Sure. And so to be so completely married to just one entity like a Facebook, it's dangerous, but it can also be, as we've seen, quite rewarding.
Okay, well, we've had a great discussion here today, and we are actually just about out of time. I'd like to thank you and our audience for listening and watching today. There's a lot more background for today's topics on our links blog at kbia.org, including a story from BBC on some of those workplace conditions that Mike was talking about at Amazon. You can also replay the show there and leave comments for us, or send them to us in an email to views@kbia.org. Our thanks to RJI's Travis McMillan for directing today's show, and to KBIA's Pat Akers for handling the audio. I'm Amy Simons. Be sure to listen in next week when we'll be back with you for another edition of Views of the News.